Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the A24 Project, where we look at two films every 2 weeks distributed by A24. In our last episode, we looked at two films, Krisha and the Adderall Diaries, that very much flew under the radar. But this week, we've got two of their most well-known and perhaps well-loved films, Green Room and The Lobster. So Dallas, you're back again. How do you feel about this week's double bill?
Oh, I'm very excited for this week's double bill. One of them is certainly in my top tier of A24 releases, and the other one is one which I was very looking forward to on the rewatch. And yes, I think both of them still hold up very highly on a rewatch, and looking forward to chatting about them with you.
Yeah, likewise. I think this is going to be really fun. I haven't watched either of these since the opening weekends at the cinema, so I'm really excited to see if it's held up as well for you as it has for me. But as always, we start with sort of A24-hour news, and it's a bit of a quiet one this week, but there's a big bit of news in there, though. And we head to the south of France, where Robert Eggers' psychodrama The Lighthouse has been named the best movie at the Cannes Critics Week and Directors' Fortnight by the International Federation of Film Critics. There's a mouthful. The victory for The Lighthouse gives A24 its first ever major prize at Cannes, and The Lighthouse, which was shot in 35mm black and white film and presented in the Academy Ratio, stars Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson as an ageing lighthouse keeper and his young prodigy. So the film, for those not familiar with it, or like me, have avoided any reviews or think pieces or any sort of reaction from Cannes, is all about a duo's isolated existence that drives them to madness. Just as simple as that. So the movie is Eggers' second feature following the breakout success of other A24 favourite The Witch in 2015. So Dallas, have you checked out any of the reviews or sort of buzz about The Lighthouse from Cannes?
No, I haven't. I'd like to go in unspoiled as possible. So the only thing I really sort of saw was the sort of critics sort of tweeting about the incredible long queues to get into The Lighthouse. They said that basically if the Palme d'Or or the prizes were awarded due to the length of the queue, then Lighthouse would have taken every single prize. Apparently this was one of the most popular films that people tried to get into, and it certainly sounds like they weren't disappointed when they finally got to see it.
Yeah, I think it's been impossible to escape that. There has been a positive buzz that's been coming out of Cannes for The Lighthouse, and apart from sort of the description I gave for the film, I don't really know what to expect, and I want to keep it that way. We're recording this sort of a week before the episode drops, so we're kind of hoping at the Edinburgh Film Festival announcement on Wednesday that something like The Lighthouse is going to get in. I've got high hopes, but I'm prepared to be disappointed at the same time. But it would be great to see a film like this as soon as possible before perhaps things start to spill out, you know, with a simple kind of description like that. And I think we've all seen the black and white picture of Dafoe and Pattinson sort of with the lighthouse behind them looking out to sea. Presumably it feels like there's so little known about this film, and I want to try and keep it that way as humanly possible, but I'm sure just something's going to creep out, some sort of spoiler, or some critic that doesn't have any sort of self-awareness will kind of tweet out something. So hopefully we can see this as soon as possible.
Yeah, no, well, I did see it could be a rumor, it was on Twitter, so it could be a rumor, but there was someone was saying that it might get a release in the US in early 2020. So it's like, ooh, that's a long time to have to wait. This could be another Eighth Grade, you know. So let's hopeful that if not at Edinburgh, it appears at London Film Festival, and we can at least see it this year before it finally gets its main release, which hopefully is in a proper cinema-wide release and not another case of Under the Lake. But I think with the fact that it's won a prize at the Cannes Film Festival, which Under the Lake did not the previous year, I think we've got a much better chance of seeing it on the big screen.
Yeah, I think that would be good. I think I saw the same rumour about The Lighthouse in 2020, and that absolutely terrified me, that I thought, like, oh my god, it can't be too long now. But then when people were sort of suggesting that the sort of 2020, I don't know where it's come from or whether that's true or not, but that's probably as terrifying as sort of The Witch, if that's to be true.
Exactly, and so fingers crossed that we keep a light on for Lighthouse. And I was expecting more Lighthouse family gags, actually, to be honest, from the UK critics in their headlines, but I didn't read into the main reviews, so maybe there's a few in there.
I've done a Twitter search for Lighthouse 2020 and nothing has really come up at all. So I feel that hopefully we'll be okay. I think it doesn't look like it's going to be 2020, but there's still no date. So it could be 2020, but there doesn't seem to be news about 2020. So it could be that the 2020 is just a rumor. I'm going mad saying 2020. I feel like a CNN pundit talking about the American election. But before we dive into sort of Green Book and The Lobster today, I'm going to pose a question to you, Dallas, and it's the same question asked in today's film. What is your desert island band pick? And if you could be an animal, what animal would it be? So I'm going to let you have a think, and we'll hook the listeners and get your answers at the end.
Okay, I'm thinking.
So our first film today is Green Room. So directed by Jeremy Solinier, hopefully that's...
Solinier,
there we go. His second feature, following the critical success of Blue Ruin, the film focuses on a punk band who find themselves attacked by neo-Nazi skinheads after witnessing a murder at a remote club in the Pacific Northwest. So the film stars Anton Yelchin, Imogen Poots, and Patrick Stewart. So Dallas, how did you come to hear about this film for the first time? And what was your initial reaction when you saw it?
I think this was one of the sort of first films sort of picked up by Picture House Cinemas when they started doing their Picture House Entertainment release strand, and it was one that got sort of certainly a big push in on the indie scene. And I think there was a really good trailer. I mean, I'd seen the filmmaker's previous film Blue Ruin, which I thought was fantastic. It stars Mason Blair, who's also in this film is Gabe, one of the more sympathetic neo-Nazis it would be if that's possible, and it's that film was a great film about a man who's finds out that the person who was responsible for a terrible crime that affected his family has been released, and he wants to sort of take revenge. But it was a case of this was a guy who wasn't really that competent at it. You know, normally in these sort of big Hollywood movies, people they all seem to know just how to fire a gun and how to do all this sort of kung fu and stuff like that. This is what happens when a realistic interpretation of when this happens, and I thought it was a fantastic thing. And then Green Room was the potential for Jeremy Solinier's sort of Three Colors trilogy, perhaps. You know, he went Blue Ruin, Green Room. I was hoping for something maybe Red or something, but I think his third film was called Hold the Dark, so it didn't really fit into the thing there. But I think what drew me in certainly to this film was definitely the fact that, and they certainly built on this in the trailer and in the campaign, was this is the film where basically Patrick Stewart plays the bad guy, and you know the trailer had the scene of him on the other side of the door sort of saying what's going to happen if things go south, and that was enough to sort of hook me in. And yeah, I was really looking forward to it, and I certainly enjoyed it when I first saw it. And what about yourself?
Yeah, I was the same. I was hooked in by a couple of different factors. I love the trailer, and I think you're right. I think this definitely was sort of the first Picture House film, and they seem to sort of pick maybe like one film a year. And this one, I was really surprised to see them sort of get the rights to. But you know, it's a fantastic trailer. You sort of look at it and you feel like it's goddamn, this looks really stressful and intense. And you know, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, so I love Anton Yelchin as Chekhov and Patrick Stewart as my captain as Captain Jean-Luc Picard. So to see him in sort of a drama like this was just looked like it was going to be a treat. And like you, I really enjoyed Blue Ruin. I was one of the few people to actually have seen this film. It's, you know, well, it got a good critical success, its box office wasn't that kind of great shake. And yeah, I think it was just one of those films that I think first time I saw it was like a Cineworld preview, so I think they showed it like a week or two early, and it was one of the most anticipated films. So I was kind of there on like a Monday night 8 p.m. to check it out, and I was sort of so stressed kind of watching it that it, you know, while the film is called Green Room, the whole film isn't sort of confined to this room as perhaps you might think, but sort of there's this room for a good chunk of the middle and sort of in and around sort of this club for the rest of it. And I just found sort of the tension of, oh my god, how are they going to get out of this room? And I thought the violence was sort of well pitched. It didn't feel kind of hokey or kind of over the top. It felt really bloody, and as you kind of said, it's realistic that people would be hacking at people with things or badly shooting things, and it sort of felt very real, and it sort of added to the stress of anything could happen, because you know, spoiler alert, a lot of people die throughout this film and kind of reap what they sow or are unfortunate victims. And I like that it didn't hold back in sort of that stakes, really.
Yeah, I know. I mean, When I rewatched it a couple of days ago, I actually checked, and the incident which sort of sets this whole thing off. I mean, so the plot is this band is sort of touring around the Pacific Northwest and they're in need of another gig to make some money. So this guy sets him up in this club, which turns out to be it's an afternoon show in a neo-Nazi bar up in just outside sort of Portland, Oregon, sort of in Washington. And basically within the first 17 minutes, they go back to the green room and find out there's a dead body in there, and they've now witnessed this. And then the club owner decides, we can't let you leave. And they're going, we need to leave. And this basically is, you know, within 17 minutes, it's like we're off to the races now. And it doesn't really let up in terms of tension for the rest of the film. You know, I think we've actually done A24 seem to be on a roll at the moment. I think the last sort of few episodes, most of the films we've watched have been at around that sort of 90-minute mark. And this is sort of 91 minutes. And yeah, he basically doesn't take his foot off the gas, you know, from that point on. And yeah, it's just nerve-shredding sort of tension. And what I really liked about the film was, yeah, there are some incredibly brutal moments in it. I'm thinking of the result of when Anton Yelchin pulls his arm back in from the door of the green room, and it's just like, oh, that is it's like horrific to see. And also there's a thing with a Stanley knife as well that I'm not going to spoil, but it's basically they're all done with practical effects. And you know, that's what really sort of hooked me in the fact that it all felt really believable. And I think there was an interview with the director who says, looking back on it, there was one point that he maybe would have changed, which was the fact that they gave the gun away out the door. But you know, everything else is basically people reacting how you think people would react. You know, you all have this idea in your head of how you think you'd react to something that's either no, you'd basically shit yourself and basically be stumbling from one moment to the next trying to figure out what to do. And it's a very well executed version of that, I thought. You never really doubt the motives of anyone at any point during this film.
Yeah, and I was sort of I kind of never realized this when I was sort of doing a bit of research into the film, that sort of the origin of this came from Solonier's kind of desire to create like a thriller set in a green room, calling the idea an obsession that he sort of had for a few years. And he created a short film set in one as part of like a 48-hour film challenge in sort of 2007. And although that one was a supernatural one as opposed to sort of dealing with Nazis, and he called it like a really kind of fun and hammy movie. But however, he still wanted a chance to do sort of his version of a green room movie, and do it the right way. And although the film he mentioned sort of features a large amount of violence, and what he describes as full frontal gore, he's gone on record as stating that it's not sadistic, and every act of violence apart from the initiating incident is done with a reason. And as such, he's kind of described that there's no gratuitous close-ups or of the recently deceased characters. So it's, you know, it's interesting. I'd love to have sort of seen that sort of mini 48-hour movie version of Green Room. I wish they'd put that on like the Blu-ray.
Yeah, no, I didn't realize that. So that's something that, yeah, I must sort of search YouTube or something. I mean, there must be a version of it out there somewhere. So yeah, no, it'd definitely be interesting one to see where the initial inspiration was from. And also, I'd be actually keen to see him do something in the supernatural genre as well, because I think he's definitely got a good eye for sort of pacing and intention and stuff like that. So I think a sort of ghost story or horror, well, I mean, this is certainly in many respects a horror thriller. So I think, yeah, that's definitely a genre I'd like to see him dip his toe into, I think.
You kind of picked up quite rightly that we're sort of in a bit of a trend at the moment with these A24 films of being about sort of that sweet spot of a 90-minute long movie. This film also brings back the Nazi dogs. How did you feel to see Nazi dogs back in sort of the A24 filmography? They're becoming as kind of recurring as Robert
I know
Pattinson.
it's one where this one seemed like, I don't know, it's almost like the dog got its own sort of redemptive arc. You actually felt sorry for the dog at times. You know, it was getting attacked, you know, it was getting kicked and stuff, and then you know, you see it just sort of wandering along the road, so then sort of sitting down by its owner towards the end, and it's just like, oh, the dog's just misunderstood. It's just been, you know, it's nature or nurture. It wasn't born bad, it was treated bad in such a way. So you know, he's not a bad dog, he's just, you know, fallen in with the wrong crowd, I think. So I think that dog has potential to be redeemed, if there was ever a sequel for it, I think.
Yeah, I did like when you see sort of the dog at the end, sort of after the whole music ends, and it just pottering on by, and they're sitting there like they shoot at the dog, but thankfully they're out of bullets, and the dog just kind of trickles on by. I really did like that. I think that was one of the redeeming moments for the Nazis, that, you know, that you can still get away. There's still
hope. No, I mean, the character Gabe, played by Macon Blair, was definitely a very sort of well-rounded sort of character. You know, he was in this, you know, he was in this lifestyle and whatever, but you definitely saw that he was maybe not comfortable with the entire thing, and I think that was a really nice sort of twist on the character as well. You know, the character, you know, Darcy, played by Patrick Stewart, is very complex as well. I think if there was one thing which I wasn't entirely sold on, is the fact that because the film basically within the first 15-17 minutes is that gets underway, I almost felt there wasn't enough time spent with the band initially to really get to know them in order to care about the outcome, to care about whether they lived or died in the following sort of 45 minutes. I mean, the only one that I felt sort of any real sort of empathy or sort of was for was Anton Yelchin's character, but that might be just because Anton Yelchin was such a likable guy in real life and in his other films that he has that empathetic quality where you want to see him survive. But the rest of them, because I'm not sure if I really even got a couple of their names, so therefore in that respect I thought it was maybe there was an emotional detachment from some of the characters that meant I didn't care about whether or not they lived or died. What about yourself?
Yeah, I think one of those ones that what kind of helped perhaps me for me is that I now love Anton Yelchin and Alia Shawkat, who is the guitarist of the Ain't Rights band. I think she's fantastic in Arrested Development, so I've sort of kind of got a built-in love for these characters, and seeing them in any sort of distress is already there for me. I could have had like 30 seconds with those characters and I would have felt upset and stressed for them when everything starts to kick in. But I think, yeah, you're totally right, and that's sometimes where you think in certain other kind of horror movies, for example, sometimes do it better, that longer we spend with the characters before everything goes to shit, you're more invested in sort of them, and it hurts more when they get the knife in the back, or they meet their kind of grisly doom. Apart from that, they might just be a generic bassist in a band or something like that, or a drummer. So you can't really rely on us actually loving these actors or these actors from out with the film.
Yeah, no, I think it's like if it had taken maybe sort of like half an hour at the beginning, you know, to get to know them, you would have had more of an emotional investment. But then I think the film overall would have suffered if it had been sort of around the 2-hour mark. I think it would have been difficult to sort of keep up that momentum and sustain that sort of tension over that sort of thing. So I understand why he's done it. But I mean, sometimes, like, you know, if people who enjoy a horror movie also enjoy the hunt and the kill, and therefore it's always fine to have a few people that you don't really care about who you're actually looking just to see get murdered, just to see how they do it in inventive, gory ways. So I mean, yeah, you need some dog or Nazi fodder for this movie as well, I think.
Definitely. So talking of Nazis then, what did you make of sort of Patrick Stewart as Darcy Banker? He's the leader of the skinheads. You know, a lot of people maybe think of him as Mr. X.
Professor X. He's got a professorship, you know. He's got a PhD and all that. You know, he's earned that title.
Absolutely. So people will think of perhaps Professor X or Captain Jean-Luc Picard. What did you make of him in this role?
Oh, I thought I was utterly convinced by him. I never doubted his motives. I think what made him terrifying was just the calm, matter-of-fact way that he went about dealing with things. He was also one who, he wasn't there to get his hands dirty. He had people to do it for him, and it was clear that everyone else sort of showed him respect and whatever. It was similar, I think, to the character Stacey Keach played in American History X, of the leader of the sort of new neo-Nazi. It's like someone with sort of tremendous sort of charisma and power that people paid attention to, hung on their every word, but didn't actually have to do the violent acts themselves. People were committed to him, and yeah, I thought he was sensational, and I would like to see him sort of play a bad guy again. I'd happily watch that.
What did you think about Imogen Poots? She's been a former guest on our other podcast, Filibuster. What did you make of her in this role as Amber?
I mean, Imogen Poots is an actress that I've got a lot of time for. I thought she was great all the way back in, I think it was 28 Weeks Later and stuff like
That's
that.
Right,
but you know, she was good in the film. I thought she was great as a sort of the character that you didn't know which way she was going to side with. I mean, she was friends with the person who got murdered, and she's clearly got a distrust for the band. She really probably couldn't care less whether they lived or died. She was out for herself and stuff like that. So in that respect, I thought she had a couple of great moments. But again, there was maybe, we didn't really learn anything about her character up until the point that we meet her in the room where it's already kicked off. And so at that point, you know, I thought it was maybe a more could have been done with her. But I mean, you do get certain bits of character development with it. I think, as you mentioned sort of in the intro, this one of the sort of great, I love a great running gag in a film that gets payoff towards the end, where, like you say, this thing about, they're interviewed at the beginning about the, what's your desert island band? And, you know, they're all trying to play cool and sort of saying Misfits and Slayer and stuff like that. And then, like, someone says, you know, sort of Simon and Garfunkel and stuff like that. And then, you know, you've got this great payoff at the end where Anton Yelchin is about to tell her what his favorite band is. She basically goes, you know what, I don't give a shit. It's just like, because at that point you're really wanting to know. He's the only one who hasn't answered by that point, and you think you're going to get the answer at the end of it. I think it's just a nice, neat little rug pull by the director to have that at the end, because you've also got that story, the paintball story, I think is a great one as well, where you're looking for the payoff to that as well. And he's sort of got that nice little sort of bait and switch, I think. And it's a nice sort of, keeps you guessing towards the end as well, which I liked.
And we can't, obviously, with a movie like this, we've got to pay sort of tribute to Anton Yelchin. What did you make of him as an actor in general, and what was your sort of reaction when he passed away?
I mean, I think he was a great sort of screen presence. He had a very sort of likeable sort of everyman quality. I thought he was great in the Star Trek films. You know, the character of Chekhov, I mean, given the original take on the character, but I think it was a very difficult role for him to go into, because he could have gone the same way as and gone over the top with the accent and stuff like that. But I think he pitched it perfectly in that it wasn't a caricature, or it wasn't like a comedic character. It was just, it felt really good. And yeah, I think it's a terrible shame what happened to him, and he's a presence which is missed. I think he could have gone on to become, you know, one of the greatest actors of his generation, and I think it's a loss, which is, he maybe wasn't as felt as, he hadn't got to that Heath Ledger level yet, but I think given a few couple of roles, because the likes of, I think it was Roger Dodger and stuff like that, I mean, also, you know, great in the Fright Night remake, which I know on Twitter recently that there's been a lot of debate over with certain people in the network, but I thought he was great in that as well. What about yourself?
Yeah, I remember sort of when I first heard the news, and I was really floored by it. And yeah, I was recording a podcast with the Top Film Society. It was all about Die Hard, and we sort of just had the news kind of broken just before we started recording, and we sort of talked about our thoughts and our feelings on him. And I feel really gutted that I feel like he was on the brink of, you know, he was starring in these films like sort of the Star Treks, you know, the Smurf movies, Fright Nights, you know, sort of, you know, remakes and character roles. I think he was in Terminator 4, for crying out loud. That's always
he was Kyle Reese, wasn't he, in a future.
Exactly, who would ever remember that?
Well, only us now on being prompted by IMDb.
Exactly, but I remembered that, because it was one of those things, he was just one of those actors that I was immediately taken with him in sort of the Star Trek 2009 remake, and I was like, who is this guy? I want to see him in everything. He had sort of that infectious personality, that smile on his face, that, you know, there's a great gif of him where the camera just moves in on his face. He's just the greatest. And, you know, sort of around sort of that kind of, not long after sort of Into Darkness, he was in Jim Jarmusch's Only Lovers Left Alive. He was sort of providing the vampires with their drugs in terms of blood, and he was sort of starting to appeal in things like sort of Green Room. I really loved him in Thoroughbreds.
That's one I haven't seen yet, actually. I really need to catch that one. One that I love him in, it's a fantastic film. I'm not sure, have you seen Like Crazy?
Yeah, I was just about to say that. Yeah, great film.
I thought that was one of the best films I saw in 2011. It's if you're listening to this, I know we're here for A24 films, but this isn't an A24 film. But please, if you're looking for an Anton Yelchin film, check out Like Crazy. It was just brilliant, that one.
Yeah, it was a fantastic one, and it was just like these roles were starting to become more and more common, and you know, it was weird. I remember when I went to see Star Trek Beyond, sort of it was, you know, one of the first films released after his death, and that one hit quite hard because like he is so good in it. After barely being in Into Darkness, he has like got a great role in Star Trek Beyond. He has so many little moments, and I remembered, you know, the Trek fan I am, it's a new Star Trek release, you know, there's so much to take in. But I couldn't stop just looking at his performance and taking all of that in. And I just thought he was one of the best things in it. There's just little moments where he's like, a scanner starts going off detecting one of the away teams, and he goes, oh. And he's just, and like he checks out a character's bomb. And it's just little things. Like, I know that sounds silly, but he really filled this character with little beats and moments that made him really special. And sort of when they start playing Sabotage, when they're destroying the ships. And, you know, at the end, they sort of pay tribute to absent friends. And at the time, it was sort of a kind of a nod to sort of Leonard Nimoy. But in sort of that final edit, you can tell that they've sort of just lingered on Yelch in just that extra few seconds. And it was a real treat. And I just think it's, you know, he could have been one of the greatest acts of our generation. And, you know, thankfully he's left us with some really great films, you know, even just one of those films like Crazy. That's more, some actors will never achieve that level of quality. And I just think it's a real shame. And when you watch a film like this, you just think, oh, what could have been? It was such a freaking horrible death. It was just, you know, I can't imagine what that must be like. And I know his family have sued the people involved, and there's been art exhibits, and I think there's going to be a documentary sort of that they've created about their son, which will be interesting, and I'm sure we'll cover in some form or another one day. But yeah, he was a real class act, and I think a film like this will stand the test of time. It may not have made much at the box office. It made less than its budget of 5 million, but I think a lot of people will continue to find this film because of the talent involved, and even just sort of the A24 name. And one last thing, I recommend you check him out in Curb Your Enthusiasm as well. He plays a young Jewish magician, and he is surprisingly a totally brilliant guy as an absolute dickhead in it. So definitely check
I
that one out.
definitely will.
So yeah, so that kind of brings us on to our next film, and that is The Lobster. So Yorgos Lanthimos broke out for a lot of film fans with The Lobster. So starring Colin Farrell and Olivia Colman, Ben Whishaw, Rachel Weisz, and Lea Sedana, this is set in a dystopian society, and David, played by Colin Farrell, whose wife has just left him, is sent to the hotel for singles in the country. So the strict hotel rules are meant in a clinical fashion to foster love, as everyone in this society, straight or gay, is to be paired up romantically. There are harsh punishments for anyone breaking the rules, and like the others, if David does not find love at the hotel within 45 days, he will be surgically transformed into the animal of his own choice. David's choice being a lobster. This transformation does not mean that does not mean a punishment, but rather an opportunity to find love as another species. So Bob, the dog that David brings to the hotel, was in fact David's brother in human life. So David will discover that his search for love is dependent on the other people at the hotel. Each has her or his own agenda in what to do if true love cannot be found within the time limit. Unaware of it, upon arrival at the hotel, David will also learn that there are a bunch of anarchists who live in the woods nearby, many of those being escapees from the hotel, and the anarchists do not tolerate coupling in any form within the group, except as a ruse when they need to assimilate into the city life. So Dallas, that is quite a film description there. What was your, how did you first find out about The Lobster, and how did you see it for the first time?
I think it was, I mean, Yorgos Lanthimos was, I hadn't seen his first film. I think it was, is it Dogtooth or something like that? But this was one, I think this was another, was this another, I think this was actually another Picture House Entertainment one. And I think it was the marketing campaign got me in. I mean, I was a big fan of, I wasn't always a Colin Farrell fan. You know, he started off doing the likes of SWAT and things like that. But it was In Bruges showed me the potential. I'm sure I've waxed lyrical about Colin Farrell on another podcast at some point, but it was In Bruges that showed me he could be a great comedian. And, you know, when he's operating outside the blockbuster system, you know, I think he is absolutely fantastic. You know, if even when in the blockbuster system, you know, he can be good. He was actually the best thing about Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And it's a crying shame that at the end he morphed into Johnny Depp. And I think that is a decision which has going to ruin that franchise because, you know, Colin Farrell was superb in the small role he had in that one and could, I think, been much better than Johnny Depp, especially with all the other baggage which is going on with Johnny Depp at the moment. But I mean, the idea, I mean, the description you supplied, you know, the idea that basically you've got 45 days to find love or you're going to get turned into an animal. And just the look of the film and the matter of factness of it all, it's not this, you know, over-the-top sci-fi future. This is basically how we are living now. But you just go out to a rural country retreat to find love. And if, you know, you're crap at speed dating, then, you know, you're going to get turned into a badger or something. You know, that was enough to hook me in. And I saw it at the home cinema in Manchester. I was down for a cinema conference and I'd arrived the night before and went along to check out my surroundings and, oh, Lobster's on. Yep, I'll give that a watch. And I was utterly blown away by it. It was one of my favourite films of that year. And I think, yeah, that was a very good year, actually. 2015 was the same year. You know, you had Force Awakens came back and reignited the love of Star Wars. You know, you had Mad Max Fury Road. But this was probably definitely up there in my top five, I think. What about yourself?
Yeah, I was excited and sort of curious by the trailer, and it seemed very much right up my street. Yorgos Lanthimos, someone I didn't really know too much about at the time. And I remembered sort of, it's kind of funny you should say sort of 2015 was a great year. I always felt like it was like, I was really liking the year, but I wasn't getting that sort of, that film where I thought, oh, this is going to be my number one film of the year. And yeah, sort of, I remembered sort of putting a lot of hope on The Lobster that it could be my favourite film of the year. And I remember going to see it after work on a Monday night. I don't know why I wasn't able to see it at the weekend. And I remember going in and I was really surprised by it. You know, I sort of expected the hotel to be sort of the entire movie, that was going to be the main focus of the film. And sort of when you watch the trailers, it really does keep the sort of the second half of the movie where they're hanging out in the woods with the anarchists, perhaps trekking into Dublin. That was all kind of kept up, you know, up its sleeve. And that kind of threw me a little bit at first. But I really kind of liked that surprise element that a film like this can kind of play though its cards so close to its chest. And I think it was all the more interesting for kind of taking that approach. It can be a little jarring the first time you see it. But I think once you settle on the idea, it made perfect sense to me.
I know what you mean. There was, I think, a lot of people, when there were people who were split on the film, there was a lot of people who weren't really sold on the sort of second half of the film. They really liked the first half set in the hotel, but when the characters leave the hotel and you've got this whole other society that you've got to learn the rules of and stuff like that, I know there was a few people who didn't like that, but I really sort of dug the seeing the other side of it, because you are basically thrust into this world in the first couple of minutes. You know, I was saying that Green Room had a quick start. You know, this is basically within the first couple of minutes. You know, you've got the first shot is a woman driving a car and gets out of her car and shoots a donkey in the head, and you're like, okay. And then Colin Farrell's getting sort of picked up and taken to the hotel because his wife left him. And it's like immediately like that. It's like, this society does not tolerate, you know, single people. We need couples, you know. The reasons, I like the fact that it never explains why this is happening. It's just accepted. And, you know, the rules are there. Everyone seems to follow the rules. They don't seem to, you know, apart from the anarchists, but people go willingly to the hotel because they want to find love and stuff like that. And some people go to different extremes to try and nurture a relationship. You're basically, you know, this idea that a relationship, you can only find love with someone if you have like an interesting feature together, such as a nosebleed, or you've got a limp or a lisp, or you're short-sighted. You know, I think it's a bit more than that, but you know, this is the sort of thing that they plug into. But I love the world building of the hotel, the rules and stuff like that. I'd forgotten Olivia Colman was in this, which, you know, it's suddenly you then realise, oh, but Rachel Weisz and her were in The Favourite. Of course, it now makes total sense, but I liked her as the manager of it and the sort of matter-of-factness of it all. The sort of scenes where they're showing you what can happen, like dining alone where the guy chokes to death, but dining in a couple, you get saved with a Heimlich manoeuvre, or a woman walks alone and like the guy just comes up behind her and rapes her. And it's like, but if he was walking with a couple, it's like, oh, no problem at all. And everyone's sort of clapping away and stuff like this. It's so sort of banal and mundane and everyday, but I think it sort of really worked well, and I just sort of loved the story of it all and the world building of it all.
Yeah, what I really like about this film is sort of that style where, you know, I'm sure we'll discuss it a bit more with sort of the killing of a sacred deer coming up, but I really like that style where it's sort of, it is very unnatural. People sort of seem very stripped of their emotions when they're talking and describing things. And I know that sort of splits some opinion. Are you a fan of that?
Yeah,
kind of style?
I am. So it's a very sort of, it's a very unique sort of humor. I mean, it's definitely a European style of humor. I mean, there's a lot of sort of the Danish sort of films, the sort of Festins and stuff like that have that sort of humor. And yeah, there is certainly a lot of that in Killing of the Sacred Deer as well, even more extreme than this one. But I just love the, I mean, it's like a shot when a woman decides that she can't find love and decides to end it all by jumping out of her hotel room window, but she's on the first floor and doesn't quite succeed in the job first time and is basically lying on the ground crying in pain, and everyone's sort of looking around, and you've got this cold, sadistic person that is just like, yeah, she doesn't care, and like Colin Farrell's trying to woo her by also pretending to be heartless and stuff like that. And yeah, and I mean, it's that kind of sick sort of twisted humor was sort of really right up my street.
One thing I know, that this is going to be a spoiler, so if anyone hasn't seen The Lobster, thank you for listening to this far. Go watch the film and come back. But sort of the film ends with sort of Rachel Weisz's character and Colin Farrell. You know, there's a romantic relationship there, and Rachel Weisz's character has lost her eyes as punishment for that. And Colin Farrell's character, David, he goes into the bathroom. He is going to make a declaration of love and cut out his eyes. But the film ends with us not knowing if he's come back from the bathroom having chopped out his eyes or what the situation is. When you watch the film and, you know, years later, what is your reaction to that?
The first time I think I saw it, I thought that he didn't do it, because the film up to that point has shown that people will lie in an attempt to get a relationship. Ben Whishaw's character sort of knocks his head on desk and stuff to get nosebleeds in order to go out with a girl who gets nosebleeds, and Colin Farrell has pretended to be heartless in order to try to do a relationship. Now, Rachel Weisz will never know if he is indeed blind, so, you know, there's a chance that he probably didn't do it. But, you know, he really does love this woman, and you know, he's tried. You know, you see it in the sort of final couple of scenes, him trying to find any other sort of common love or trait between the two of them that they could work on, whether it's, you know, do you like blackberries, you know, do you like this certain type of animal and stuff like that, you know, do you like this piece of music and whatever, and he can't find it. So, you know, it's, I think in the second time, I think he probably does do it. I mean, it's a horrible scene. You can see the knife sort of going right up to the eyeball, and it's like, oh God, you almost want to look away. But I think second time around, I think he does do it. What about yourself?
I've never thought he's done it. No. I remember when I watched it the first time, I expected to see him, like, it's kind of, it stays on this shot of Rachel Weisz's character. She sat at the dinner table just waiting for him to come back. And there's this glass, you know, this behind her. And I always expected to see her, Colin Farrell's character, just like walk behind her, just behind the glass, like as he's sort of running away. I get the sense that he just doesn't have it in him, because I'm sitting there thinking, I don't know how I could physically put a knife into my eyes and cut out two eyes, let alone one eye. And I get the impression that David is a bit of a coward, a wet blanket, and I just don't think he has it in him to do it. So watching it again, I still get that feeling that he just couldn't do it.
So do you think he was going to run away, or do you think he was going to just pretend to be blind in an attempt to continue the relationship?
I never considered that he would pretend to be blind, but I did think he would run away, and I think he would get banished to some sort of back to a hotel or something like that, or face punishment. But I think he's a coward. I think he is a normal human being, probably, in that respect, as much as you can get normal within a sort of Lanthimos film like this.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's the humor of the thing. I mean, you know, he's great at that. Colin Farrell is great at that sort of absurdist sort of humor. I love the way that they're sort of escaping from like the group, and he's sort of running along the road, and he goes, oh, I'm sorry, I can't run any faster, my trousers are too tight. Or there was a great line, it was like a when a couple gets put together, it's like if you come across any problems or tensions you can't solve yourselves, you'll be assigned children. That usually helps. I mean, it's that kind of, I just cracked up at that line. I just thought it was brilliant. It's just like, yeah, if in doubt, you know, when a couple runs out of things, it's like, oh, kids, okay, yeah, we'll try and see if that makes it work. You know, that kind of thing I thought was great. But, you know, one thing which isn't really explored in the film, and one thing I'd like to know your opinion on is, you know, there's a brief discussion about how the process is done, but is it true that, do you think that their consciousness is transferred into the animal and therefore they're like living within it, like in a Being John Malkovich kind of way, you're within it, an animal, and so they've got the thoughts of the human, whatever, just in the animal body, or do you think they just get turned into an animal with no memory of what they had before?
I don't know how they could do it. Exactly. It's all behind that one door as well. I wonder if it's the guy from Tusk or something in there that carries it out. Like, I don't know. I really don't know. What I love about kind of the film is that world building, that in sort of this comedy, you know, drama, that they do so much world building and make it so casual. I would love to know where the inspiration for this film came from, how they devised the rules, how they decided to go with it. I just think it's incredible writing. It's a great piece of sort of science fiction in a way.
Yeah, no, I'm convinced. I think it must have sort of received some awards for the screenplay, because I thought the screenplay was exceptional, but also, you know, a great sort of, you know, I love sort of film locations, and so I was really wanting to know where this hotel was, and apparently it's the Park Snilla Hotel in sort of Southern Ireland. But apparently, a short boat ride from that area, you get to Skellig Michael, which was the set for Luke Skywalker's island in The Force Awakens and Last Jedi. So you could almost, you know, capture two film locations with one single trip. So it's something which has been on my list for a while, and I would love to go over and see both locations, stay in the hotel and then take a trip to Skywalker Island, you know.
I feel like there's gonna be an A24 project road trip coming up again.
Planes, trains and automobile and boat trip, I think. Yeah, absolutely. Certainly not just by car this time.
So do you have any sort of final thoughts on The Lobster or Green Room?
Well, I think, you know, I was rewatching the Lobster, and I was thinking, here's a film set in a hotel that has a very strict set of rules, and features a man, you know, who's grieving and loses his dog. And I was thinking, is this the art house John Wick? Potentially. Who knows? You know, could we see a sequel where, you know, he rebels against the animal world or something like that? Who knows? I would love to see this turn into a John Wick style art house trilogy. I think it'd be something which would be quite unique, I think. But I thought Killing the Sacred Day was great. I love the favourites, so I'm all in for the next sort of Yorgos Lanthimos. So whatever he does, it's going to be absurd, but I'm all in at this point. He hasn't let me down so far. And with the Green Room, I think it's one which is a fantastic film, maybe slightly light on the emotional engagement, but I really actually do need to check out his new film, Hold. I think it's Hold the Dark on Netflix. It's one which has been on my list for a while, but I need to get around to it. And based on the rewatch of Green Room, I'm certainly going to load that up on Netflix very soon, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think this has been it's almost like 20 minutes longer than our last episode sort of discussion.
Says something about the quality of the films, possibly.
Yeah, I think you can tell we're both passionate about these movies. So yeah, thank you very much for everyone that's listening and everyone that's been leaving reviews in the iTunes stores and downloading and streaming the episodes. It's been really heartening to see people are kind of joining us along for the journey as listeners, so I really appreciate it. So for those that are leaving reviews, thank you very much. And if you haven't had a chance to leave a review, please leave a couple of kind words, a couple of stars, whatever you can spare. It's really appreciated, so thank you very much. And I'm looking forward to returning in a couple of weeks with De Palma and Swiss Army Man, so another two interesting movies. Have you seen those ones, Dallas?
I haven't I've seen Swiss Army Man, but I haven't seen De Palma, so I'm looking forward to catching that one the first time. But you haven't asked me, you were going to ask me the questions. I haven't given you my Desert Island films yet and all that. So yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you want to know?
So what is your Desert Island pick and what animal would you want to be?
Well, Desert Island pick, it was like, I mean, my wife will know, my musical taste basically ran from around about sort of 1996 to about 2000, so it was a very sort of small window where I actually really sort of cared about bands and stuff like that. Most of my stuff is now listening to film soundtracks. So I was thinking, do I pick John Williams? But then do I pick Hans Zimmer? But if I was going to go for a musical artist that I would want to, someone who could take me to different places, you know, whether it be different countries or outer space, so I would have to pick David Bowie. Has to be David Bowie for me. He's probably the greatest songwriter of all time, and yeah, I think I love more of his music than anyone else, so yeah, definitely Bowie for me. What about yourself for your desert island pick?
This is a tough one because it could change any day of the week, yeah. But I'm sort of in a bit of a Jeff Buckley vibe again. I loved him when I was a sort of teenager, so I've kind of backtracked again to that, like most people. So Jeff Buckley would be my choice. And what animal would you like to be most?
Well, again, this was one that I was giving a lot of thought to, and I was, you know, because he says he wants to be a lobster, but then I was thinking, given Blue Planet and all the pollution in the waters and all the plastic and stuff, I don't think I'd want to be, you know, living in the water. So then I was thinking, do I go for a really long living animal? But then, you know, you're basically something like an elephant where you're going to get hunted, or a tortoise where you're going to live on an island and basically you're going back in the sea and probably going to end up with a plastic straw in your nose. So I thought I'd go with something that enjoys the solitary life. You know, if you haven't found, you know, a partner in, you know, human form, you might not find one in animal form either. So someone that is apparently very solitary and enjoys its own company is the red panda. So I would like to go to be like a sort of trash panda, rocket raccoon, red panda type of thing. I think if I have the ability to speak, I'd become like a rocket raccoon in real life, I think.
That is a class answer. I was kind of torn. I was debating sort of going for one of these sorts of pandas that get sort of treated like royalty in a zoo because they're endangered. And it's like, I wouldn't have to worry about being hunted if I was sort of safe in one of these big sort of super zoos. I'd get food all the time. I think I'd be quite happy. I'm not much of an animal person, so I struggle to think of animals that I would want to be. But I think I'd be quite happy to be a panda.
Excellent choice, yes. A black and white panda. I'll be the red panda. You can be the black and white panda. So we've both gone for pandas. Synergy.
Though I've probably cocked it up royally, because they're sitting there like, you've got to find love as one of these animals, and I've just realised I've picked an animal that is in danger of going extinct because they do not shag. So yeah, I might have made a mistake there.
Okay. There's the rub.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you very much for everyone for joining us, and we'll see you again in 2 weeks' time for De Palma and Swiss Army Man.